As for the implementation, I mean, truth be told, we have no idea what the plan is. Personally, I don't know if the plan involves in-race enforcement. I kind of would be interested to see that, though. I could see a situation where there's a race official, you know, who's monitoring everything going on, and in the race is actually ready to go, you know, show someone a yellow card for doing something wrong in the middle of a race. Then that would actually allow for some, you know, real-time enforcement of the rules.
I like the idea of somebody on the back of a motorcycle, yes, just like holding up a card. Yeah. That would add something to cycling, I think, and that would be fantastic. Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. It's Thursday, April 27th. Got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about Romandy, which is on right now, a bit of Soudal Quick-Step's classic season, a bit of where on earth is Miguel Angel Lopez. We actually know exactly where he is. He's not too far from where I am right now. We're going to get into a bit about Adam Hansen's yellow-red card system that has been thrown about. Talk a little bit about Primoz Roglic's Twitter hack, Tadej Pogacar's wrist, a bit about the very unfortunate story of Zaf. We're going to be calling up Joe Lindsay for that. And an announcement just this morning that Justin Williams is starting his own Criterium series called Crit. We're going to dig into that a little bit later in the show. Joining me today, how are you, Abby Mickey?
I'm good. I'm kind of bummed that, like, I mean, the people won't know, but, like, we know this, that we've already recorded this podcast episode, and no one will hear about Ian's sadness shirt.
Well, the people didn't know until you just told them, Abby. This was going to be the magic of editing. Nobody was going to have any idea that we already recorded most of the show.
Hello, I'm doing super well today, Kaylee. Thank you for asking. Happy to be here.
No, we should be transparent with the audience. That's part of our shtick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we recorded this yesterday. We had some audio problems specifically with Abby's XLR cable, appears to be kaput. And Ian was on that show, and he will be in this show. Actually, he will be in a bit of this show. We will sort of like call him up basically and use a bit of that show from yesterday. But he's sick today, and we're recording this well before he actually wakes up. So he's not going to be on the most of today's show. And unfortunately, like Abby referenced, he was wearing a very funny sadness t-shirt.
And the best part of his sadness t-shirt was the plug that was plugged because of his shirt. And that's that everyone should listen to the Album Files podcast.
There you go. Everybody should go listen to the Album Files podcast. Many more, I don't know, inside jokes with ourselves and the podcast we already recorded. We'll try to just continue to move on past that. Also joining today, Dane Cash. How are you, Dane?
Hi, Kaylee. I'm doing great.
All right. Well, let's get into today's episode. Like I said, we're actually going to call up, sort of through the magic of editing, we're going to call up Ian later. We're also going to call up Joe Lindsay and talk Zaf. But before we get to either of those things, we want to talk about, well, some of the racing that wrapped up last weekend and the racing that's happening right now. So Dane Cash, Romandy is on right now. This is one of those stage races that kind of gets overlooked a little bit. It wedged in between the end of the classics, you know, basically in between Liège and the start of the Giro. You know, a lot of the big names are kind of looking toward the Giro at this point from a stage racing perspective, but it's still some good racing over there and there's some interesting things happening. So what's going on?
Well, the first thing I think we should talk about is the sort of continuation of Soudal Quick-Step's really impressive half a week here. Of course, Remco Evenepoel won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and depending on your point of view, may have saved Quick-Step's classics campaign or not. Some people, I think, would disagree. But in any case, I think Soudal Quick-Step is very happy with how things turned out on Sunday, and they are probably still happy, continually happy, over the next couple of days because they won the prologue at the Tour de Romandie with Joseph Czerny beating world champion Tobias Foss in the prologue. And then stage one, they also won with young British up-and-comer Ethan Vernon. So that's basically three World Tour wins in a row for Soudal Quick-Step, a team that podcasts like ours have been critical of so far this year. They've done a really nice job of compiling victories outside of maybe their traditional stomping grounds of the cobbled classics.
Patrick Lefevre did mention that podcasts were being mean to him. And I'm not sure he was talking about us. In fact, I'm pretty sure he wasn't. But yeah, podcasts have been mean to them. But like justifiably, right? I mean, until Sunday, they had a pretty quiet spring, at least from a high-profile perspective. And more importantly, they didn't succeed in the races that they quite vocally want to succeed in, right? And so I guess my question is that Liège victory, does that kind of make up for the spring, or is this sort of outside their... It's outside what they normally do, right? Does it count?
I feel like it doesn't make up for the spring. I mean, for a team that's traditionally been the team of the cobbled classics, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, while it's a monument, it's still kind of on the outskirts of the spring classics. It's like the last spring classic. It's in the Ardennes, not actually, you know, I wouldn't really think of it as part of the true classics campaign. And so I feel like even though they did win that and they won it convincingly, it's still that one victory for me doesn't salvage what was a really bad season of racing for a team that really values those spring races being from that region. And especially that, like, for example, they finished the classic season, or they went into the Ardennes with less points than Movistar, which you would never have predicted.
Movistar, the team of the spring, though.
Yeah. That Matteo Jorgensen.
I mean, it certainly didn't save their cobbled classics. Yeah, if you want to consider the classics sort of mostly focused on the cobbles, then sure, then it didn't really say that. But I think in general they've had a fine season so far. I think, yes, their traditional focus, they were pretty bad at it this year. They're pretty bad at racing on the cobbles. But at the same time, everything else that they've done has been pretty good. I mean, Remco Evenepoel has been a really strong rider basically all season. I don't think they set out trying to completely transform from a cobbled racing team to something else. I think their hope was that they would continue to thrive on the cobbles with Casper Asgreen and company, and also pick up wins elsewhere. But you know, at the end of the day, they're a top ranked team still, and they're still winning races or contending for races that most other teams would be very happy to thrive in.
There were a whole pile of abandons, Dane. Are there any of consequence? Anything that's going to affect the Giro, for example?
Yeah.
Or future races?
So first of all, I think there's a segue here from Quickstep, which is that the team that, I mean, if you want to actually talk about having a bad season, Astana is not having a good season. And apart from Alexei Lutsenko's Giro de Sicilia victory, they haven't won a lot. And that frustrating run has continued at the Tour de Romandie, where Mark Cavendish is out of the race after two stages, not even two stages. Alexei Lutsenko himself out of the race as well. And Cavendish, this was his last, you know, big tune-up before the Giro. And so I think Astana might be hitting the panic button with this whole season really so far. We're already almost in May, and they just don't have a whole lot to show for it, and now Romandie did not really turn out already as they had hoped. So not just Astana, though. There are a few other riders that have already pulled out of the Tour de Romandie. Simon Yates is the really big kind of race contender who DNF'd on stage one, I think due to illness. Rui Costa, another high-profile rider, former world champion, but also his departure from the race is kind of, you feel bad for, because if you've seen the video, he ripped his chain ring off rolling out of the start ramp and banged his knee hard, and it was not good, and so he's out of the race.
Yeah, and if, for anybody who's missed the story that Ronan put up on escapecollective.cc, basically his mechanic ran 1x chainring bolts on a 2x chainring setup, so 1x chainring bolts are a little bit narrower. They were long enough to put the chainrings together, but the whole thing was basically held together by like three little threads, and the second he put in a hard effort to get off the start ramp, his chainring fell off. So not a great look for frankly, for the mechanic over at that team. They do look different, single chainring bolts and double chainring bolts. Rotor, who make the chainring and crankset, and they were the folks that told us this, they did say that the team went through and double-checked all of the other bikes to make sure they were prepared with the proper chain rings. But yeah, just a super unfortunate. You don't see sort of like major mechanical failures like that all that often at this level, because the mechanics are working with kind of the same gear over and over and over again. They're very good mechanics. I don't doubt that this was also a very good mechanic. This might have been a very tired mechanic or something like that, which does happen. It's just a human error, basically. But it was a weird moment on the start ramp at the prologue at Romandy.
If I'm really Costa, like I'm disappointed that it's not because I'm super strong that my chainring got ripped off. I wouldn't want anybody to tell me that. I would like to go through my life thinking I'm just that strong that I could do that with my legs.
But then you'd be worried about doing it again.
True.
You don't want that to happen.
That's true.
Yeah. Just like kind of unfortunate all around. And there was a bunch of flats that day as well. It sounds like there was maybe some flint or something after a rain. There was one team that I think like all seven or eight guys flatted literally at the same time. This is in recon. So they had to like rush in a big street sweeper thing ahead of the actual race. And for the most part, I don't think it affected the racing too much. But yeah, initially there were reports of like glass or tacks or something thrown because there were so many flats, but sounds like it was just a natural phenomena, again, caused by like some recent rain and the fact that these time trial tires are really, really thin. A mechanic described it to us as just a like chaos and sealant, basically, all over the place, because a lot of them are running tubeless now. They've got sealant. It's just sealant spraying everywhere. And in particular, like some of those time trial specific tubeless tires are just they're paper thin, and so it doesn't take much to slice them up.
For more, as you said, go over to escapecollective.cc. Also, you could consider subscribing.
Could.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. It's a good thing to do. Supports this podcast, supports everything we do. Supports independent journalism. It's very important. Very important. Next on my list here, the sort of weird, wacky tale of Miguel Angel Lopez, who is now riding for a Colombian team. And he's doing so at the moment. Well, actually, up until I think like 10 minutes ago, was riding the Tour of the Gila, which is sort of one of the biggest domestic stage races here in the U.S. It's one of the last remaining stage races here in the U.S. It features some quite difficult climbs and is much of it is at altitude. It's a really, really hard stage race. I think it's a 2.2, right, Dane?
That's correct.
So there's a lot of like, you know, sort of domestic elite teams. The riders that win it are, you know, usually sort of domestic pro kind of level. And then all of a sudden you've got a guy who's won a bunch of Grand Tour stages show up. He won the sort of major climbing stage by, I think, a couple minutes. I haven't actually seen the numbers.
Seconds. We know he
55 seconds. Actually, that's closer than I thought it would be. Anyway, he showed up and you know, he's just sort of he's another level, right? Like it's that's just the way it is. But then apparently, Abby, today it sounds like he crashed out, unfortunately. So he's out of the Tour of the Gila at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a big crash on stage two and a couple guys are out, but that includes Miguel Angel Lopez, who is in the leader's jersey.
And who, assumedly, I mean, based on his form and the fact that he won so handily in the first stage, was the favorite to win the overall. And now it's all wide open.
I would hope that he would win the overall. Yeah. I mean, like I said, he's a step above most of the other riders in that particular race. And I don't know. I guess it's kind of cool that he's at an event like that. I mean, if you're Project Echelon, for example, which is like a domestic elite team with a bunch of Boulder riders, I used to see them riding around all the time. You know, it's kind of cool to race against an athlete like that. Even if he is probably just going to kind of drop you whenever he damn well pleases when you're going up.
Yeah, I was at a stoplight with a Project Echelon rider just the other day, and it's cool to think that he and his teammates get to race against somebody who is good enough. There are other reasons why he's not racing at the World Tour level, but to, you know, potentially be a Grand Tour contender, certainly a Grand Tour stage winner. So that is a cool opportunity they have to race against that level of talent, although not anymore apparently due to that that crash. I should say, I pointed this out on yesterday's podcast, there's already pretty strong level of talent at the Tour of the Gila. Our own Abby Mickey finished 10th on GC there 1 year and was the top 10 in a boatload of stages. So, I mean, this is a very high-level race.
I finished third on GC, but thank you.
Third on GC.
So that's not, yeah, that's not on PCS. That must have been before the race was, you know, sending results to PCS.
Dane, explain, for the listeners that do not recall, why is Miguel Ángel López a name that we have mentioned at the Vuelta and the Tour de France and others, and why is he at the Tour of the Gila this week?
You know, I think he would say because it's a great race to go race. I think what you're asking is why is he not racing at the World Tour level? And
pretty much
that's a deeper question. He was racing for Astana. The team we just mentioned was already having some issues this year. And the team decided to cut its ties with him because he had some kind of alleged connection, alleged involvement with a doctor in Spain who was being, you know, looked into as a drug trafficker, basically. There's a lot of question marks around exactly what his involvement was, and what exactly the police were, you know, investigating and looking into and how that connected to him. But he was basically mentioned in multiple media reports as being kind of connected to this case, where Spanish police were looking at this doctor for, distributing drugs to athletes. And he may or may not have been connected. So Astana decided we don't want to have any connection to him anymore. We want to axe this rider. So they did. And he felt pretty hard done by that decision. But he is now racing with a Colombian team at a much lower level. And it is for that reason that he went to the Tour of the Gila and is no longer, you know, making a Giro bid this year like he might have otherwise been. We haven't really gotten much of an update on that story or what his involvement, you know, whether police have uncovered any further evidence there, whether he's involved at all. That's all very much up in the air. Astana took the decision to cut him as soon as kind of it became reached a fever pitch, that, you know, the mentions of him in the news. And so Miguel Ángel López is racing in the Western Hemisphere now.
I was chatting with Rebecca Rezzo, a freelancer who is actually at the Gila right now, and she was supposed to have a sit-down interview with López tomorrow that we were potentially going to run on the site. I'm not sure if that will happen now that he is potentially out of the race. I'll chat with Rebecca about it. She's also doing a cool little project down there. She just started something called Radio Tour US. It's on Instagram. Lots of interviews and results and things like that from races that are, frankly, pretty hard to get interviews and results out of, and I say that, you know, as somebody who runs a media company, doesn't tend to be a place that we put a lot of resources for a lot of different reasons. But Rebecca's doing a great job down there, so go follow Radio Tour US on Instagram. Tell her we sent you. If you want to follow some of the Tour of the Gila stuff, or if you just like sort of the U.S. domestic scene, actually like sort of the Americas scene, I would say. She's a Spanish speaker as well, and so she does a fair amount south of the U.S. as well. Anyway, let's move on to some other topics here. I want to chat about something that popped up in a survey that new CPA, which is the Riders Union, Men's Riders Union, I should say, new CPA president Adam Hansen put out to athletes. And one of the things that was sort of proposed and like close to unanimously approved or approved of was a yellow card / red card system in pro cycling, kind of akin to the one you find in football / soccer, which I'm going to call football from here on out because I think a lot of our listeners like that. There's not a whole lot of details in this plan. Just sort of like, is this an idea that you like? And I think, you know, what Hansen will do now is he'll go take this to the UCI and say the riders want this. Can we make it happen? But I just think it's an interesting concept to kind of think through and talk about. And I wanted to get your take, Abby and Dane. What do you guys think of a yellow card / red card system in pro cycling?
I really like it, and I can think of two instances in the women's Peloton in 2022 where this would have come into play, I think. For me, when I was reading Adam Hansen's tweet about this or info about this and looking that over, what came to mind for me was an incident where Marianne Vos was disqualified from Vegarda West Sweden, the one-day World Tour race, for doing the puppy paws for like 3 seconds. And an incident that happened at the Tour de France Femme of Zwift where Nicole Frayn collided with Marta Cavalli after a couple big crashes. And so for those two incidences, like the Marianne Vos, she was disqualified, and that seemed like a very drastic reaction for me for 3 seconds of puppy paws. And as soon as the guy on the moto like looked at her, she was like, oh yeah, right, sorry. But she was still disqualified. And the incident with Nicole Frayn, obviously it was an accident, but it was still reckless riding that endangered another rider and took her out for the rest of the season and has impacted her 2023 season. So like for me, when I look at those two incidences, I'm like, okay, yeah, a yellow card for Vos would have been a way better reaction than disqualification from a race that she actually eventually won. And then the victory was handed to Audrey Cordon-Rigaud. And for the situation with Nicole Frayn, she wasn't penalized at all. And it was for people watching, and also for Cavalli, who was drastically impacted by that situation, it was kind of, I think, unfortunate. Not because, obviously, like I said, Nicole didn't mean to collide with Marta, but it was still reckless riding. And I think there needs to be some system in place that will penalize riders for riding recklessly, because otherwise the only time the UCI steps in is when it's like a Dylan Groenewegen situation where another rider is seriously injured, or the situation that happened at Flanders with the Bahrain rider who rode into the peloton. And it's more a reaction of like how many people were taken down than that the riders did something dangerous.
Yeah, lots of riders ride up the side of the course. That happens all the time. And the UCI has tended to punish outcomes instead of actions. And I think a big part of that is because there's been no halfway step, right? Like there's been no yellow card, which is kind of what you need to punish actions a lot of the time. Like a disqualification for just an action that may or may not harm anybody is a lot. And because they haven't had that option, I think that they've tended to go sort of one way or the other. They've gone with absolutely nothing, no punishment whatsoever, to disqualification or bans or suspensions and things like that. There's no middle ground. Dane, how would you see this kind of working?
Yeah, that's exactly why I like it. I feel like the two strike aspect of it is very helpful, because right now the sport doesn't have a lot of mechanisms for, hey, don't do that, but we're not going to kick you out of the race the first time. Because right now those are basically fines. The disciplinary measures are fines, which don't really achieve that much for like a potential race winner who might do something wrong. Okay, I'll take a 100 Swiss franc fine to do something mildly wrong. And then, yeah, the other measure is just kicking them out of the race or relegating them, and that's a very extreme measure. So,
yeah, as for the implementation, I mean, truth be told, we have no idea what the plan is. Personally, I don't know if the plan involves like in-race enforcement. I kind of would be interested to see that, though. I could see a situation where there's a race official, you know, who's monitoring everything going on, and in the race is actually ready to go, show someone a yellow card for doing something wrong in the middle of a race. Then that would actually allow for some, you know, real-time enforcement of the rules.
I like the idea somebody on the back of a motorcycle. Yes. Just like holding up a card. Yeah. That would add something to cycling, I think, and that would be fantastic.
And that way, it's, you know, if you're doing the puppy paws, for instance, then the race official comes up to you, holds the yellow card at you. You know, you gesticulate because you're like, oh man, why? Just like in soccer. And your home fans are very angry, just like in soccer. But it means you don't get kicked out of the race. You then know, okay, I shouldn't be doing this anymore. I will stop doing this now. And if I do it again, I'm out. And that is potentially, there might be some, you know, further infrastructure required to make this happen, where there's actually a race official handing out yellow cards in the middle of a race. But I think it's preferable to kicking someone out for littering or kicking someone out for doing a banned position for a little bit.
Well, I think the other really important thing here would be to have officials or jury, which is what we have right now, that are very visible, right? Because in football and soccer, the referee, the official, is on the field and standing in front of the athlete and handing this out, and the fans can see what's happening. And in fact, in some sports, the officials even have to kind of explain why they're doing things. And I think that would be also incredibly valuable, because right now what we have is this situation where punishments are handed out by a jury. Fans don't even know who that jury is most of the time. Most of the time, reporters don't even know who that jury is until something happens. Like the biggest incident that I recall, I think it was a 2017 tour. It was the one where Peter Sagan basically crashed out Mark Cavendish, or the other way around, depending on which way you look at it. And you know, the entire press room of the Tour de France is like scrambling around trying to figure out who the jury is, who's making the decision around a disqualification. Spent 15 minutes doing that before we could even like move on to other bits of reporting, because we don't know. And I think that the only way to make this work is to have some level of accountability for the person or people making those calls, which means they need to be public and visible. And they probably, to help mitigate like questions of, just to make the decisions, back up the decisions with some heft, they probably need to be like former pros, right? A lot of the sort of officials need to be former pros or something. Or there needs to be some kind of jury like there is right now, or maybe it's two or three people, and you know, if two vote, then you get your yellow card or your red card. I think it's worth the UCI kind of thinking through. I think it's worth maybe experimenting with, trying to implement, because I do genuinely think it's a good idea. And Abby, you mentioned the tweets that Adam Hansen sent out before. Like, the response to this from pros was really good, right? Like, do you recall what the percentage was that approved?
I think it was
100%
of the people the riders surveyed. It wasn't the whole peloton, obviously, but it was 100% of the riders surveyed were in favor of the red card, yellow card system, which I feel like that's the whole point of the CPA, right? Is to take what the riders want to make the sport better and put that into place. So for me, looking at it, it's like, okay, well, if the riders want it, then that's a no-brainer. We should figure out how to make this work.
I agree.
The UCI should figure out how to make this work.
Yeah. I think it's a really fascinating idea, and I hope that something comes of it, right? Like, I hope it doesn't just sort of get sent out in a survey and nothing ever happens, like a lot of this stuff. Abby, you have to go to an appointment, I believe.
I do. Yeah, thank you so much. Okay.
See ya.
See ya, Abby. All right, Dane, it's just you and me. To sort of like, I don't know, unpack the sausage, show how the sausage is made a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, we record this on a Wednesday. We're all over the world. We're trying to figure out time zones, which is one of the hard things. We basically have to either choose U.S. and Europe or U.S. and Australia. Thankfully, Abby's actually in the U.S. right now, which is handy. We're trying to figure all this out, and then everyone's got their own recording gear, and none of us are audio engineers, and sometimes stuff goes wrong, and we have to go again.
We got to rehearse. We got a whole rehearsal.
So I hope you can't tell that some of the things we've talked about here, we talked about yesterday, which actually isn't that different, because most of the time we're talking about things in this podcast that we have talked about previously amongst ourselves.
Like, the Slack channel already has a lot of things we've said.
Anyway, let's take a trip in the Wayback Machine to yesterday when Ian was on this podcast, and let's ask him about Primoz Roglic's Twitter hack.
Let's do it.
On to much more serious topics. Primoz Roglic had his Twitter account hacked and briefly became a massive fan of anime. And you can guess who's going to tell us about that.
Yes, Primoz Roglic has had an excellent adventure on Twitter over the weekend. In the lead up to the Giro, where he's probably got other things to be worrying about, his Twitter account got hacked and his 130,000-odd followers were suddenly confronted with Primoz Roglic telling them about a thing called Milady Maker, which is a collection of 10,000 generative PFP NFTs in a neo-chibi aesthetic inspired by street-style tribes, which is certainly a selection of words, but not one that makes a lot of sense to me. So it's basically NFT anime bullshit, and there is a... I'm going down the rabbit hole of all of these NFT things because Primoz Roglic's account has been handballed from one NFT project to another NFT project. After it was a M'Lady Maker account, it was a Meebits NFTs account, which is a project under the sort of umbrella of the people that brought you NFT projects like Bored Ape Yacht Club, which is one that you might have heard of if you're invested in this dumb space, which is marked by a lot of scams. And then it's changed again to a cryptocurrency trading platform. So it's kind of a bingo card of the worst things on the internet, which is fun for me. And it also kind of comes back to Elon Musk in a way, because he's made such a mess of the verified account system over time, which has led to the scammers targeting these credible accounts with these big followers and then flipping them, changing the username so that the original owner can't get back into the account. And then handballing it from one place to the next, probably selling it on the dark web. It's all very interesting.
I just appreciate that these things still exist. Like, I thought NFTs and cryptocurrency, like, who's still doing this?
Well, I'll tell you, Primoz Roglic is still doing this.
Of course, other than Primoz Roglic and apparently a bunch of anime fans.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a cesspool. I was just looking through this thing from this NFT conference or convention that was being promoted by Primoz Roglic, apparently, which is in Tokyo, and it's just a bunch of people that take their little NFTs out to McDonald's and they get burgers together, and it's just pictures of them eating burgers, and it's like 400,000 people liking and retweeting and viewing these tweets. It's not small. But it is depressing, so that's good.
I would. I mean, I don't need the NFTs, but I would go for the rest of the fun that you just described.
Oh, you'd go for McDouble burger
right,
in Tokyo.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I think one of the other, whenever these things pop up, and then the sort of like numbers behind them pop up, like the numbers you just gave, it really puts cycling in perspective, does it not? Like, we are. This podcast is. The anime NFT of sports, basically, right? Like, think about how many people go and do that and are into that, and how many retweets you're talking about, and think about the average thing in professional cycling. It feels to us like this whole big world, but we're tiny. We're no bigger than hamburger eating anime lovers.
And we are. I mean, if Escape Collective was doing some of the numbers that the M'Lady Maker Remcon Tokyo Twitter account was doing, I think we'd be pretty stoked. I'm literally looking at a picture of a burger here, which has 42 quote tweets, 23 retweets, 183,000 views, and that's just telling these people to go to McDonald's in Tokyo and eat a burger, and you might win a surprise star face emoji.
Did he get his account back?
He did. So I've been sniffing around this story since the weekend because it really combines all of the worst things about the internet, which I love. And some enterprising cycling fan in America somewhere, when the Twitter handle got changed to something else, snatched it up, contacted Roglic's team, and eventually the handle made its way back into his possession. So twitter.com/Rogler is now back in Primoz Roglic's hands and not in the hands of NFT scam artists. And
but he lost all his followers.
He lost all of his followers. So he's slowly building up. He's, at time of recording, he's got 3,500 instead of 130,000. But he has done one tweet. It is, guess who's back? And then sunglasses emoji. And that is actually doing very good numbers on Twitter. So there's a happy ending to this story.
I do kind of like this is all Elon Musk's fault as well.
I think everything is at some level.
Well, thank you for that update there, Ian. I appreciate that. Well, we miss Ian on today's podcast, but we're glad he was on yesterday's. Let's take that Roglic topic and go kind of tangential to that and talk Pog. Rog and Pog, they go together. Pogacar had a pretty nasty crash at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Actually, well, Mikel Honoré had a pretty nasty crash, and it sounds like Pogacar ran into him or ran over him and was all involved in the same incident and ended up crashing and fracturing a scaphoid in his wrist and a lunate bone, I think is the other one. Not a doctor. We wanted to provide a little update on this and just basically discuss whether it will have a long-term impact on this season, because obviously we're hoping to see him back at full strength for the Tour de France, which is, while it is a ways away, it's actually not that far away, right? It's basically 8 weeks away at this point. It'll come before we're quite ready. So, quick update on that. Dane, the official word was 6 weeks before.
Yeah, the team has said it's roughly a 6 week recovery time for Pogacar, which would ostensibly put him back before the tour starts. But it might derail his build up a little bit.
Yeah, and so I think the question is that's probably sort of return to racing, right? 6 weeks to return to racing, and he can definitely ride before then. He is the type of rider that likes to race a bit in the lead up to big events, right? Normally we'd see him in the Dauphiné or Tour de Suisse or something like that. Sounds like Dauphiné might be right on the edge of that. I think Dauphiné is like 7 weeks from the injury to the Dauphiné, if I remember correctly. Before we get into Joe Lindsay's true capital J journalism later in the show, my capital J journalism for the day was walking across the street and talking to my neighbor, who's a doctor and also a cyclist, and asking him what he thought of this. And he was basically saying, yeah, the lunate bone, I guess it doesn't get a lot of blood flow, so it takes quite a long time to recover fully. But he was basically saying, you know, riding on the hood's probably uncomfortable for a while, but he, for example, could ride a TT bike like almost immediately because you're putting most of your weight on your forearm and he's all sort of casted up. Pogacar put a photo of his little wrist cast up with like drawings on it and stuff like that. So that's good news. I mean, in theory, you know, at the very least, he could like be sitting on Zwift basically immediately, and even outside, it sounds like he could probably get onto a TT position. The question would be like, can he stop? Can he hit the brakes? Stuff like that. Nonetheless, it sounds like he can ride, right? I mean, he broke an arm, not a leg, and we are cyclists here. But yeah, this could impact the tour, and I think that's what we're kind of hoping doesn't happen, but it's definitely possible.
Yeah, the team has suggested that he's going to be, you know, back to training relatively soon, in some capacity or another. But not being able to train just as exactly as he had hoped, yeah, I mean, before the biggest race in the world, a race that he didn't win last year because Jonas Vingegaard beat him, I think it could definitely have an impact, and hopefully won't have too big of an impact, because I think everybody wants to see that big showdown, the big Pogacar versus Vingegaard versus whomever else. At the Tour de France.
I'm very much looking forward to that, for sure. I mean, frankly, like, if Pogacar isn't, if it's clear early on in that race that he is not in full form, it's gonna be a rough Tour de France, I think, from a suspense perspective. We'll leave that there, because we don't really know. Like I said, talk to my doctor neighbor. That was about it. We've got a bit from the team. I do genuinely think that, like, given Zwift, given the sort of other ways that he's able to ride, I don't think it'll have huge, huge, huge impact. But at the same time, you know, it only takes 1% or 2% at the Tour de France to make a pretty, pretty damn big difference. So yes, we're going to find out in July. Next on my list here, CRIT, all caps, CRIT. This was announced by Justin Williams and his Williams Racing Development, I think is what the program is called. So what this is a Criterium series. Justin Williams, obviously the founder of Legion of LA, which is a team that also has a couple other sort of city-based teams. Now, the reason I wanted to bring this up, because we don't, obviously, we don't cover a lot of sort of US criterium racing here on this podcast, but this one's particularly interesting to me because of its sort of proximity and some similarity to the NCL, the National Cycling League, which was launched last year and just had its first race about, I think, 2.5 weeks ago or so in Miami. There's a lot of similarities between these two things. And I should say, first and foremost, that the CRIT, the Williams project, is not calling itself like a league. It's not trying to create, you know, league with franchises and all the other things that the NCL is trying to do. But I know from previous reporting, from speaking with Justin, from speaking with other people involved in Legion for the last couple of years, that like what the NCL is doing is basically what, you know, Justin Williams has always wanted to do. And in fact, there's quite a lot of overlap between these two projects, not least of which is the fact that both are sort of funded and somewhat guided by people from the sort of like sports agency world. On the NCL side, one of the co-founders is one of the biggest agents in the NFL. And then on the Williams CRIT side, the funding is coming from Wasserman, which is one of the biggest sort of talent agencies on the planet. It's like $8 billion worth of contracts is what they're involved in, which for them means roughly $730 million in potential revenue over the life of those contracts. It's a huge, huge talent agency. And it's also the one that has represented Justin Williams for the last 5 years.
Really puts cycling into perspective. And we talked about it a little bit with NFTs and sort of the Bitcoin world, and how when you talk about the numbers, the amounts of dollars involved in that, and you talk about our sport, it's like, oh, okay. Billions with a B? Oh, that's a lot.
With a B. Yeah, and Wasserman is, like I said, providing the funding for this CRIT project. They are framing it as an investment, which is what's interesting to me, because they're not framing it as a sponsorship. They're framing it as an investment, which means that they're expecting a return at some point, which also indicates to me that potentially the scale of this is a bit bigger than a couple, like an open criterium series, right? Because there's sort of two different ways to go about this. One is the NCL version, which is this league with franchises, and they have their own teams and all the rest. It's also this, they're trying to build a kind of closed, basically business that they can sell like TV rights around, right? And on the other side is, you know, something like the American Criterium Cup, which is just basically a series of races. It's kind of what was pulled out of the ashes of USA Crits when all that fell apart. The latter, the sort of like open series thing, that's pretty hard to get any significant revenue out of, and it's definitely hard to get real growth out of. And I can't imagine you'd get a lot of investment for something like that. That tends to be stuff like, you know, funded by sponsorships, funded by USA Cycling, that sort of thing. And I struggle to see that as being the final goal of this Justin Williams CRIT project. Like I have to imagine that they're gonna tilt at some point a little bit more towards the NCL model and end up some kind of league-like thing. That's the only way that I can explain the sort of the Wasserman connection, unless it is truly just a sponsorship, in which case, forget everything I just said.
Also worth noting, the I in their acronym, CRIT, it comes from the word international. So maybe they have plans of spreading abroad.
Also possible. Yeah. There's been a couple interesting series that were able to do that. Red Hook is, you know, Red Hook had Barcelona and things like that. You know, my first thought was Justin Williams has been the national champion of Belize, which I think is where his parents are from. And, you know, they could do an event down there. I didn't really go into the details of what the events are or like where they're be, because mostly we don't have that information yet. I know that there's going to be up to three is what they said, and they're going to be, you know, sort of in city centers and major sporting arenas is what they said. So I don't know if that means inside stadiums or what. But yeah, we don't have a whole lot of information about sort of like the details of the vision. I just found the story more interesting from a kind of like broader, which direction are these two different entities going to go, CRIT and NCL? Which are they competing with each other? Are they working sort of alongside each other? And given the fact that, like I said before, they have a lot of sort of have a lot of things in common in terms of like the sort of core concepts behind them and even the people behind them, and they were at one point probably even closer together. I mean, for example, the currently head of operations and teams at the NCL, Reed McAlvin, is the former head of operations at Legion, right? So like all this stuff is kind of intertwined in a really interesting way. For sort of a more succinct version of what I just explained on this podcast, there is a written story that I put up this morning on escapecollective.cc. Go check that out. Let me know what you think in the comments. And yeah, this is a story that I'm gonna keep an eye on because I think it's fascinating and I think it has huge ramifications for the future of American cycling, basically. You know, the last line in the story that I wrote is sort of the way that I'll cut things off here, which is like, the one thing we do know is that when you dump 10-ish million dollars into the American crit scene, like, it's going to have an impact, and it's probably going to have a good impact for the people actually in it, right? I mean, even here in Durango, there's a couple riders who ride for the Denver Disruptors, and, you know, they're like, they're college kids, right? Like, they're trying to make it into the pro ranks. They're going to Fort Lewis College here in town, and they're now getting paid to ride their bikes, which is not something that probably would have been happening without these projects, right? So at the very least, it's a bunch of money getting dumped into something that could use some cash. So I think that's a good thing, and it's just a matter of like watching how it all plays out and getting more details. So I have asked for a lot more details. I've had a long list of questions over. None of them were answered, but actually one of them was answered. The league question was answered. It's the only one I got. But yeah, I'll update you all as we get more. Now, last in today's podcast, we're going to jump over to a discussion, Dane, that you had with Joe Lindsay, right?
Yeah, your capital J journalism was walking across the street to talk to the doctor. My capital J journalism is having Joe, the capital J journalist, over to my apartment to ask him a bunch of questions about all the reporting that he did. So, hopefully, there's some insight in there about the what the heck is going on over at Zaf Cycle. I mean, I don't even know how else to intro or say it. It's like, what the heck is going on over there, that the team has really had some issues. Okay, so my hard-hitting journalism for the week is to invite a hard-hitting journalist over to my apartment and ask him questions, because he's done a lot of work on the Zaf story. Joe Lindsay, great to have you on the podcast.
Nice to be here.
We already kind of set up what we're doing here in the recording that Kaylee and I did earlier today. We're here to talk about Zaf, the team that I think started with high hopes for them and other people who joined the team, and things have kind of fallen apart. You wrote a really, really, really in-depth story over at escapecollective.cc, which, if you're listening to the podcast, you should go check out. Can you just give me the key kind of points? What has happened at Zaf? What happened at this team? And I know you wrote a very long story, but can you kind of just sum up the basics here for anybody who doesn't know?
Yeah, absolutely. The TLDR on it is that we'd heard rumors in March that they were not paying their riders. And obviously this is something that happens from time to time in the sport where teams get nicked for this. You know, they're not paying salaries. And so I thought, well, let's look into this. And when I did, when I started talking to people around the team, what I found was a lot more. And basically it was a team that seemed like, in the words of one writer, a women's team that did not have respect for women. So they weren't paying riders, they weren't supporting them properly, they weren't giving them, you know, the equipment that they needed to ride races and do their jobs. They were treating them poorly with all kinds of like controlling behavior and sexist comments and overall, and it just sounded like a complete mess and obviously the kind of thing that was worthy of a story highlighting what was going on.
So as of this week, where were their finances based on all the digging that you did? I know you did a lot of digging.
Yeah, and the short answer to that is I don't know, because what I found here is similar to kind of what was uncovered a couple of years ago with NextHash, you know, that Ian and I wrote about separately for different publications at the time, but it was a similar situation where there was this sort of web of interconnected companies, and in Zoff's case, they're all connected to the team owner and founder, a guy named Riyad Belatresh. And just to give you some backstory on that, Belatresh's whole idea for starting the team is supposedly to honor the legacy of his grandfather, Abdel Kadirzov, who was a pioneering Algerian cyclist who rode in the Tour de France in 1948 through 1951. So that's like the sort of the big story about the uplifting story about Zoff. So fast forward to present day, Beletresh wants to sponsor and own this team, and he's basically doing it with his own money and says he has, you know, €4 million per year for a budget to spend on the team, which is a massive amount of money for a continental team, especially. That's close. That's pretty much world tour level. And when I looked into the finances, it's not clear where this money comes from or if it even exists, because you have this web of companies in Spain, Algeria, Dubai, that are all connected to Riyad Beletresh, but there's not much money there. There's not much financial activity. And the only significant financial activity that I did find was basically what looks like a grant of shares in another one of his companies. So like if I started, you know, Joe Lindsay Incorporated and decided that Dame Cash should be a shareholder in it, I could transfer you 1 million shares valued at $1 each, and then you'd have $1 million in equity in Joe Lindsay Incorporated, which would be great. Except what's that based on? And in this case, I couldn't find what that's based on. So I don't know if there's real money there or not. The family seems to live fairly lavishly. So there are, you know, rumors that Riyad Beletresh is tied to the Algerian oil and gas industry, all of this kind of stuff. But I'd never found the real source of their money, and much less why they're not sharing it with the team, why they're not meeting their contractually obligated, you know, requirements.
So it seems as if they convinced enough people that they had a large financial foundation, regardless of whether they actually do have that foundation. Mm-hmm. And now we're realizing that either they don't have the money or for some reason they're not paying it to their riders. How did this happen and why?
So I think some of this comes back to the way that continental teams are regulated and sort of and licensed. And as I looked into this, I was actually a little surprised to find there are 179 men's continental teams and 60 UCI registered women's continental teams. Every one of these teams basically has to go through a licensing process where they provide all the documentation that they need to get the licensing the license that they need to race the following year. That's way too much for the UCI itself to handle. So for continental teams, they deal with it by farming all of that regulation and oversight out to the national federations, in this case, the Spanish Federation. There are, you know, on the face of it, they do have some pretty good requirements on what they're supposed to provide, what those teams are supposed to provide for documentation. They have to supply all the contracts that they have with the riders and the staff. They have to supply a budget sheet. They have to supply the bank guarantee that's this, you know, this amount of money in a bank, an escrow account, basically, that is used for these exact situations where a team can't or won't pay its staff and riders. They have to also, the significant point here is that they have to provide some sort of proof of the finances that are going to support it, either in the form of a signed contract from a sponsor, or in the case of this, basically some sort of proof of finances behind the team. The question is, what form that proof takes, how deeply the Federation looks at that. So like when I pulled up documents for this company that's connected to the company that is the paying agent for the team, the top line there shows €46 million in total business activity. And you're like, okay, that seems reasonable. It's not until you dig much, much deeper that you find that the vast majority of that, €43 million, is this complicated share swap arrangement, you know, creating shares in another company nominally valued at blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
Is this actually real money or not? So did the Spanish Federation look that deep? Did they not ask questions because they, like everybody else, you know, as Iris Slappendel from the Cyclists Alliance told me, everybody wants projects to succeed. So There's some magical thinking going on there. Was there magical thinking here? I don't know, because the Spanish Federation didn't return my request for comment. Naturally.
As of today, so there have been a number of high-profile departures, probably the biggest one being Audrey Cordon-Rago,
right,
who left the team, and the team has just been losing riders because they're not being paid and they're going elsewhere.
Right, left and right.
Where do things stand as of today? We're recording on Thursday.
So when I published our story, at that point, they were sitting, they had 15 riders originally, and they had lost 7 of them. So they were down to 8, the bare minimum for a UCI team, UCI women's continental team. Just yesterday, they lost a 9th with Ebtissam Zayed, who is the Egyptian champion, posted on Instagram that she was leaving the team as well. So they are officially below the threshold of what is the minimum number of riders for a continental team. The question is, what does that mean and when? The UCI rules, as I'm sure will not surprise anybody listening to this, are a little vague on that. Exactly what happens, what the timeline is the team allowed, God forbid, to try to sign riders to get back above the threshold? How long might that window be? These are all questions that our colleague Johnny Long asked the UCI in an email today. As of now, so far as I know, we have not heard back, so we don't know. The team is still supposedly going to start this weekend in the Rivolta. They are also still invited to the Women's Itzulia, but they have voluntarily backed out of the Vuelta Femenina, and that was, as far as I know, was the only other race that was on their calendar. So barring any dramatic turnarounds, they're probably done as of mid-May, if that.
Which is a pretty startling turnaround given the sort of hype, and also a real shame considering a lot of the riders, Audrey Cordon-Rago in particular, had kind of already gone through a team collapse in the past several months because they were coming from a team that had already kind of gone under.
Right. And that's part of what set this up, is with Audrey Cordon-Rago, with Maggie Coles-Leister, with Heidi Franz, and Lizzie Stannard. There may have been more than that, but all of those riders were linked to the B&B Hotels team that, as you mentioned, you know, collapsed because they couldn't find a sponsor either. And that's what set them on course to join Zaf. So this is not twice now, in basically the past 6 months that these women have been forced to look for a new team. Some of them have found new teams, but not everybody. Maggie and Michaela Drummond are going to race on the track for their immediate future, but both are still looking for road teams. Heidi's working on finding a team as well.
Okay, so as of the time this podcast goes up, the team still exists, but they don't have a long-term race program anymore. They don't have enough riders, as far as we know, to continue according to the rules. Things seem like they are reaching a point where they might not exist anymore, but as of publication time, they still exist for now.
Right. Things could change between now and this afternoon.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So obviously a story to keep an eye on, but most importantly, a story that you should just go read over at escapecollective.cc. Joe, thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when we kicked off Escape Collective in early March, one of the names that was sort of new to this group, we'll say, was Joe Lindsay, but he's floated around the sort of the bike journalism world for a very long time. And I was trying to express like on Twitter how excited I was to get him. And I think maybe a lot of our kind of the folks that already knew us didn't know who he was or didn't know why I was so excited. And I hope that you now have some indication as to why I was so excited about getting Joe on board. Is he's just a really, really good reporter. He's a really good journalist, really good writer. He makes everything that we do here better too. Like he's heavily involved in sort of editing and, improving all of our work. And I think that Zaf story is a perfect example of his excellence. And really an example of the type of thing that we want to be able to bring you at Escape Collective, which is we want to give reporters the time and space to dig into that stuff. That story was weeks in the making, weeks in the making. And, you know, yeah, you read it in 12 minutes or whatever, but Joe probably put, 80 to 100 hours into that sucker. So when you sign up with Escape Collective, that's one of the things that you're paying for, is you're paying for the ability for Joe to go dig into these very important stories and make sure that we can tell them properly and that we can tell them truthfully and that we can, hopefully help kind of hold the sport to account and move the sport forward. And we want to do that as well as, Ian's silly stories. Today you got Roglic's Twitter page. We want to be able to do all of these things, right? And that takes members. So if you are listening to this podcast, if you're a fan of this podcast, if you're a fan of any of our other podcasts, my request is, pick up your phone, head over to escapecollective.cc, sign up. It's how we fund all of this stuff. It's crucially important if you want this to continue to exist. So thank you. Dane, anything else to add? from today's episode?
I think we summed it up quite nicely, Kelly.
I appreciate your time, Dane. Thanks to Abby for jumping on, even though she had to pop off early. Thanks to Ian for jumping on, even though he was sick. Thanks to Joe for jumping on. We'll be back next week with another episode of Placeholders. And in between, you'll get a pretty serious bike racing podcast on Monday, a Wheel Talk on Tuesday, a Geek Warning on Wednesday, and then we'll be back next Thursday. Can't wait. Bye, everybody. See ya.